so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Remember all their faces. Remember all their voices.
On Wednesday.
So you are listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio on unceded Coast Salish territories. We have a very exciting show today in the spirit of the season, which is the Pride season. We have a show that challenges things that we know about sexuality, gender, and reproduction in animals, as well as we're talking to queer and genderqueer femme activist Hanna Lau about a talk that they did back in December regarding trickle-up activism as far as animal and queer liberation. So to start off the show, we have Joan Ruffgarden joining us. And Joan is an American ecologist and evolutionary biologist. She's well known for her theistic evolutionism and critical studies on Charles Darwin's theory of sexual selection. Her book, Evolution's Rainbow, exemplifies a lot of these critical studies. She released her first novel in April 2015 called Ram 2050, which we'll also be talking about today. Hi, Joan, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. I'm glad you were able to join us. So what initiated the desire or need for you to create Evolution's Rainbow?
Well, this is about 10 years ago. The 10th anniversary edition was just released by UC Press. And if we think back to 10 years ago, there wasn't widespread acknowledgement that there even was, that there even were gay and lesbian, if you will, animal species. And homosexual or same-sex sexual behavior generally was regarded as aberrant and as only taking place under stressful and desperate conditions. And this was 10 years ago. And so I was curious simply about whether that was true, whether the narrative that was being taught in biology courses was correct. So I started what I thought was going to be a fairly simple project of making a short list of the species that were known to have same-sex sexual behavior. I knew off the top of my head around four or five at the time. And lo and behold, it turned into hundreds, and that there was a whole panoply of sexual and gender expressions going on and taking place in the animal kingdom, some of which have corollaries or parallels in human cultures, but not all, and not always necessarily in a comparable way. So that's why it was news. It was brand new at the time.
Well, that sounds very, very exciting, obviously, to kind of embark on this and the study. So since the book challenges Darwin's theory of sexual selection, which is a theory that seems, from your book, to be based a lot off of gender stereotyping rather than actual animal behavior, yet is still widely accepted, what has your response been from the scientific community?
Oh, well, a lot of them are apoplectic. It's the only way to describe it. But over the last 10 years, the scene has been slowly changing. At first, as I say, you know, there's just anger and dismay, to put it mildly, that I would challenge Darwin's theory of sexual selection. But the facts are that the kinds of stereotypes that the original sexual selection narrative is based on just don't apply very widely throughout the animal kingdom. I mean, they occasionally apply, but the whole notion of these stereotypes that are in that theory envision that females are coy and males compete with one another for access to females. And so males are always competing all the time with one another, and females choose the best male in order to acquire the genes that the best male is supposed to have. And this is a very common narrative that you still hear, even on nature shows. But there are a huge number of assumptions behind that narrative that aren't correct, not the least of which is that there's a hierarchy of genetic quality among males, which doesn't exist. From a female's point of view, you're wasting your time if you're trying to choose males on the basis of their genes. They can choose it on the basis of their wealth, but their wealth has nothing to do with their genes. And so there are a lot of grounds for female choice. But then on the other hand, is the female-male interaction primarily about females choosing the best male? And instead, it's, I argue that it's very often a negotiation as to who's going to conduct what parts of the labor that's involved in successfully raising offspring. Because from natural selection's point of view, so to speak, what you care about is the number of offspring that actually are produced and delivered into the next generation. What doesn't matter is just simply how many matings there are. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is how many offspring get delivered into the future. And that involves typically or often collaboration between the male and the female, and a lot of courtship, I think, is about that and not showing off genetic quality.
And there's
There's
also discussion in the book about intersex, hermaphroditic individuals and animals that can change their sex. What do you think these animals can teach us about our own ideas on sex and gender?
Well, the major challenge has to do with whether the binary between males and females is itself a universal, which it isn't. In fact, most species are, if you include plants and animals and all the invertebrates living in the ocean, most species don't have individuals who are separately male and female, but they have individuals who have both male and female functions simultaneously. So if you just think of a flower, for example, a flower has both a male part and a female part. The male part is the part that makes the pollen, and then the female part is the part where the pollen sticks to. And so most plants are hermaphroditic, that is, they have both male and female parts. And under in the ocean, I would say about half the species offhand are both male and female simultaneously, starfish, snails, and even some fish, including popular aquarium fish. So it's only in the terrestrial world where you see a lot of species where there's this separate male and female, and also a lot of the insects generally have separate male and female. But that's a derived condition. That's not the original condition. And so that's one of the main things to realize, is that there's no natural universality to male and female being in separate individuals. And then, of course, the other main take-home message is that there's a lot of changing that goes on. You mentioned sex changing in fish, but even if an individual is male at one time, then they can change into being a female or vice versa. And I mean really change, so they change from making sperm to making eggs, or they change from making eggs to making sperm. So they're called sequential hermaphrodites. And then the other type of hermaphrodites are the ones who, like a flower, like the plant, are making both the sperm and the egg simultaneously. They're called simultaneous hermaphrodites. So all of these possibilities exist, and that doesn't even get into gender, because there are multiple genders within a great many species. And I argue that might also be the case in humans.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, going off that, about gender, because you talk a lot about in your book how some species have up to four or five different genders as separate from sex. How do you think in the animal kingdom, how would you describe the concept of gender and how they relate to it?
Well, so in order to talk about animals, we have to take the notion of gender and widen it from beyond the human context. Many people think of gender as solely a human construction, but that doesn't take account of the organic basis to gender, even in humans. And I define gender as the appearance and behavior and developmental history of a sexed body. And so a sexed body means a body that can be classified as either making eggs or sperm. And that's where its label as being male or female comes from. So a body is a female body if it makes eggs, and it's a male body if it makes sperm. But then it turns out that sexed bodies have different entire life histories in many species. So in a lot of fish, there are two kinds of fish. The salmon, for example, right up in British Columbia, there'll be the hook-nosed salmon, which is a male, but then there'll also be a jack, another kind of male, which never grows a hooked nose. And they become reproductive at about 3 years, if I recall correctly, and hooked nose maybe around 5 years. And they're entirely different morphs. They live different lengths of time. They have different shapes and different colors, and they go about life differently. And yet they're both males because they both make sperm. So I call those different genders. And of course, that might also be true in humans. The problem with extending the concept to mammals generally is that the gender variation isn't as in discrete categories the way it is, for example, in the salmon, there are two types. There aren't intermediates between those. But in mammals, you frequently get a lot of variation within the sex that could be as great as the variation between distinct genders in fish, let's say. And that, I think, is what's more common in mammals as well as in humans.
Great. That's so interesting. And with so many cases of same-sex or same-gender pairings that have been proven over time, thousands, I believe, why do you think there's still so much denial amongst the scientific community to acknowledge this?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's denial anymore about the reality of same-sex behavior in species in nature. I mean, that was 10 years ago. I think the reality of the phenomenon now is pretty generally agreed, but the explanation of the phenomenon is another matter. That's where the controversy is. And so there's various theories for why there's same-sex sexuality, ranging from those which view it in their scientific theories, ranging from those that view it very negatively being caused by a bad gene, so to speak, which manages to worm its way, so to speak, into the gene pool. And then there are theories which view same-sex behavior as incidental, as unimportant. It just occurs and no big deal. And then there are theories, such as the ones I favor, which view homosexuality as an adaptive trait, and that it's brought about as an evolutionary innovation in the species in which it takes place. And that if you were to somehow eliminate it by, say, culturing or breeding it out of the species, it would then just re-evolve if you gave it a chance.
Okay. And do you have any, talking about the same-sex pairings, do you have any particular favorite stories or behaviors of same-sex mating rituals among non-human animals?
Well, I suppose the favorites in this regard are always the bonobos, who employ same-sex sexuality all the time throughout the day. One of the most interesting cases about the bonobo is that the same-sex mating between females is face-to-face. And the females rub their vulvas next to one another and then squeal and have an orgasm. And this is called genital rubbing or GG rubbing. And if you see pictures of the bonobos at this time, the vulval area is swollen and red and very sensitive. And this is a way of exchanging mutual pleasure. And then this leads to alliance building. And I think that the bonobos, who happen to be our closest non-human relative, living non-human relative, make a very interesting case. Then the other kind, which I always find very interesting, are the same-sex courtships among birds, and also among fish, in which you have two different genders as males, and so one gender will solicit a male of the other gender to come and join him as a team to court females. So that's also interesting. The bonobo case, you have females of the same sex and the same gender. Females look alike. They're not in different genders, and they're also in the same sex. But in the case of the species where they have multiple genders per species, you get intergenderal courtship occurring, and that's always very, very interesting.
Well, that is fascinating. Hi there, Joan. It's Alyssa at Animal Voices here. And I am, well, unsurprisingly, given your background in biology, your brand new novel, Ram 2050, animals feature prominently in there. Can you give us a bit of a sense of more of your vision of how humans and non-human animals might live together in the not-too-distant future?
Yeah, this is my most recent project in my first novel. And I grew up in Indonesia and the Philippines, and I was always interested in the imagery and the stories behind Southeast Asian and East Asian and South Asian narratives and ethics. And the Ramayana is a fabulous one because it involves a hero who rescues his kidnapped wife with the aid of animals, especially monkeys. And I was always interested in whether this vision that's in the Ramayana would actually be possible in the world. Is it just purely fantasy, or could it actually happen? And that's why I wrote Ram 2050, is to try to envision whether by the year 2050 we could communicate with animals, and then in a way and with a kind of depth which would allow us to have a moral community that would include animals. And so that's what the book explores, and based on the Ramayana's plot as a sort of scaffolding to let that theme unfold.
Wow, it sounds very fascinating and epic in a way. It's a hero's journey, is it not?
Yes, it is a hero's journey. And the hero's name is Ram, and in the Ramayana, Ram is the incarnation of the great god Vishnu, and so he has superhuman capabilities. So in order to develop a comparable hero in Ram 2050, I had to postulate or imagine that the hero was himself genetically engineered, and he was endowed at the time of his conception with about 10% of his genome being drawn from other non-human primates. So he comes out with capabilities that animals have, and that of course enables him to pick up on how animals talk, and for animals to recognize him as a friend in part, and not just as an enemy about to destroy their habitat. So it sets up the possibility of Ram being able to work with animals, and as they gradually learn to talk to each other and learn what each other's life is about, then they become allies in each's common cause. Mm-hmm. And the animals have some agendas of their own that Ram helps out with, and then Ram has his agenda, which is to rescue his kidnapped wife, and the animals pitch in and help him. So it envisions a world in which there's a fusion both morally and culturally of humans with animals, as well as a fusion bodily and organically of people with animals. So the human-animal boundary is slowly dissolving in, as I say, both respect to our bodies and our morphology, but it's dissolving culturally. And I think this is possible. I don't know if this will happen, but the idea in REM 2050 was to develop this as scientifically plausible. So there's no magic in this. It's laid out in a way in which you can envision that this possibility would actually or could actually occur.
Wow, it sounds fascinating, and I love the idea of you know that you've put your strong biological background into a fictional novel. It just sounds like a fascinating read, and I can't wait to get my hands on it. Thank you, Joan.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thanks so much, Joan. So that was.
Thank you. Okay. Bye bye.
Bye. So that was Joan. I'm really looking forward to reading RAM 2052. And for more information or to order both Evolutions Rainbow and RAM 2050, they're available on Amazon. Or you can check out ram-2050.com for more info about this book.
Darlings, Sean Treviel here for Fruit Salad. Join us every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. for community news and events, live performances and music, fantastic guests, and just general fabulousness that you'd find in a fruit salad. Support your community radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. There's nothing else like this in Vancouver or in the world. Listen in. Thank you.
One thing that I've noticed in the mainstream LGBT movement and the mainstream animal rights movement is that there's kind of two different strategies for messaging. So in the one hand, I find that you often have animals presented as animals and people represented as cute, totally like us, totally like you and your family and your pets, innocent, pure, relatable, normal, deserving of our compassion because you can relate to them and you feel like they're like you. And the other thing that I've noticed is that we represent LGBTQ people and animals as tragic and subjected to so much violence and discrimination and tragedy. And I feel like both of these strategies of representing them as cute and relatable and normal and also victims of tragedy and violence is actually harming us seeing them as individuals and is actually harming our liberation movements. We could actually apply this kind of model to the animal rights movement, and we think about what types of animals are the most prioritized and given the most visibility, and it would be those most relatable and cute animals. And I would like to see the animal rights movement really relying on a lot more empathy and wanting to connect to those animals as individuals and actually wanting to value every single animal life, no matter how similar or dissimilar they are to us. One thing that I've noticed in the main...
All right, so that was Hannah Lowe on their powerful speech that they did with DXC's open meeting back in December, which was on the topic of LGBTQ and animal liberation. So Hannah Lowe is a queer, non-binary femme of color, living and loving in Denver, Colorado, a self-described molecular sociologist. They are interested in how structural violence impacts folks' well-being and quality of life from the macro down to the cellular level. They envision a queer paradise in which all beings are safe, happy, and free. They work to abolish human and animal and non-human cages while building effective and sustainable alternatives. They are proud to call Survivors Organizing for Liberation Black and Pink, and Direct Action Everywhere their organizing and activist family. Hi there, Hannah, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. So to start off, can you tell me what urged you on the path of animal liberation?
Well, I actually came to being vegan first in a fairly apolitical or not animal-centered way, I guess. I actually came to it from sort of an environmental standpoint, and then only after I had been vegan for a while, I sort of had the space to think about animals, and then got plugged into a really great community of people who were advocating for total animal liberation and haven't gone back since.
Great. And you're also involved in many other areas of social justice. What caused you to make the connections between animal liberation, queer liberation, feminism, and racial equality?
Well, I do identify as a queer, non-binary person of color. And as a human person who is holding all of those different identities, they're just ways that oppression impacts me. And so as somebody who does hold human privilege, though, I wanted to leverage the power that I have as a human to speak up for non-human animals and help create a world where everyone has autonomy over their own body and can live the lives that they want to in the company of the people they care about, which I think is something that's a fundamental right for all beings.
Of course. And in your talk that you did as part of a Direct Action Everywhere conference back in December, you speak about trickle-up activism versus trickle-down. Can you share with our listeners what these terms mean in animal activism as well as queer or other forms of activism?
Sure. So the idea of trickle-up social justice comes from trickle-up economics. And the idea is that if you give resources to people who have the fewest amount of resources, then they're going to spend them because they need to instead of holding on to them. And then you have a lot more economic activity in the community. And so in terms of redistributing justice, it works in a similar kind of way. And so if you're able to take care of the people who are the most down and who have the least privilege and who are, you know, least have the least access to resources, then you'll actually be able to take care of everyone. And I live in the United States where, for example, we don't have universal health care. And so there's sort of the typical way that a lot of the LGBT community is advocating for health care is through marriage, which obviously is only going to take care of people who are going to be married and who are going to get married to a partner who does have good health insurance. But if instead we're advocating for, you know, universal single-payer healthcare coverage, then that will take care of everyone from the bottom to the top.
Yeah, and just
and
going,
so
keep going.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So in terms of how it would apply to animal rights, we have to really be careful about how we're talking about animal rights, because there is a very clear hierarchy within non-human animals in terms of who is prioritized. And a lot of that has to do with charisma and attractiveness and intelligence. For example, there's a lot of animal rights groups right now talking about Cecil the lion and how it was so terrible that he was hunted by a dentist and shot and all that kind of thing. But he is being sort of put up on this pedestal that a lot of non-human animals don't have. And so I'm worried that we're sort of prioritizing his life as more important than the lives of the tens of billions of animals who are killed every year, very casually.
Mm. Yeah, and you talk a lot about assimilation and kind of going off what you were saying about marriage equality. I also noticed this in Pride celebrations and Pride events. A lot of them are very corporate-minded and marketed to more, like, homonormative people or people, and especially I see a lot here, it's really, it seems like white cisgender men are really prioritized in these events. What are your thoughts about the same-sex marriage legislation in the U.S. that recently passed, current Pride festivities, and how do you think queer activists can work towards a more egalitarian movement?
Well, I think it kind of comes to the same thing about prioritizing the issues that are really matters of life and death. So marriage is kind of making progress in terms of becoming more ubiquitous in the United States. But what are queer and trans activists doing to secure, you know, to secure housing and healthcare and to ensure that people can't be fired, you know, for being queer or trans? What are we doing to really make sure that people can survive in this world instead of only sort of dealing with the very top tier of people who are getting married? And a lot of people say, you know, marriage, the same way that a lot of people say that being vegan or not eating animals is a personal choice, and it's a personal choice that shouldn't have to, you know, don't impose your personal choice on me. People use the same argument with marriage equality as well. And what is happening in some places in the United States is that marriage is replacing other types of relationships, legal relationships. So in some places, people maybe used to be able to get healthcare benefits through their domestic partner, but now that marriage, gay marriage is happening more ubiquitously, if they don't get married, then they won't be able to hold on to those types of benefits that they used to have as an unmarried couple. And so people talk about it, you know, if you don't want to get married, then just don't get married. But the issue is that there's so many material benefits attached to marriage, and it actually is having a negative impact on people who are choosing not to be married because some of those rights are being stripped away.
Yeah, and I also want to say a lot of, there's not been a lot, but the activism in LGBTQ communities the recent years has mainly been focused on marriage, it seems like. So I feel like a lot of queer activists are maybe thinking, oh, well, we're done now. We don't really have anything else to fight for. Well, many other people are still, you know, being oppressed and marginalized routinely.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. What are the mainstream LGBT organizations going to focus on after marriage? Because that has been such a high priority for a lot of people with a lot of income. And so the money, you know, is the money going to dry up? I fear that it might. And what are the next things that we're going to work on?
Mm-hmm. So on a different note, as someone like personally who has always had a concern and interest in animals that society sees as less desirable, rats, snakes, lizards, spiders, snails, etc. And as a queer individual, I really appreciated your talk about trickle-up activism and social justice. I wanted to ask, how can animal liberation activists work to adopt a more trickle-up approach to animal activism?
Well, I think it really just sort of, a lot of it depends on how we're talking about animals. And some people do work on social single issue campaigns, which I think is fine if we do it in a particular way. So for instance, there were some activists who did a disruption at the Vancouver Aquarium. Mm-hmm. And I think doing that thing is great if you were bringing to that a message of total animal liberation and not just that we care more about these types of animals because they're bigger and smarter and more similar to us. So even thinking about, well, for instance, thinking about what a lot of people consider pests. So, you know, thinking about like mice and different animals that maybe we don't want to cohabitate with, how are we going to treat them? So we have a choice between, you know, we have a choice between poisoning them or using live traps or fixing our houses in ways so that they're not going to be able to get in. And I think that it's important, even for these animals that maybe we don't want to live with, that we are still respecting their lives and making sure that we're coming up with a situation that's going to work for everyone. And it makes, you know, coming from an animal rights perspective where all animal lives are valuable, even the ones that maybe we don't want to, you know, be right next to, we need to make sure that we're respecting, you know, even the smaller animals that may be annoying to us and that that aren't the dogs and the cats and even a lot of the pigs and chickens and things like that that we tend to advocate for.
Thanks, Hannah. It's Alyssa here. I was just kind of further to that question. What are you seeing changes in the animal rights movement that either give you hope or that really concern you? Like kind of looking at what's been happening over the last, say, you know, couple years, what kind of shifts are you seeing and kind of how do you feel about that?
Well, one network that really does give me a lot of hope is Direct Action Everywhere, because I feel like I'm part of this network as a disclaimer, but I feel like they really do have a message of total animal liberation. And I also appreciate that they depict animals in more empowered ways, because I think historically what I've seen a lot is that animal rights groups will post a lot of really sort of traumatic, gory footage of animals being killed and cut up and served. And it's just, I feel like showing that kind of footage both causes human beings who might want to get involved to turn off, and also that it furthers the perception that these types of animals are commodities. I think that even if that type of footage is being shown by an animal rights group, if there's a, you know, a disrespected body that's being shown, I think that it still is not helping human beings connect with that animal as an individual. So I'm really hopeful seeing a lot of different groups depicting animals as individuals with autonomy and personalities. And I think that it's important to really think about the animals that maybe people haven't connected with too much. So I volunteer a lot at a rooster sanctuary, and it's mainly birds, although a few other animals. And so I think that it's important to talk about the uniqueness of birds, because they are much less similar to us than some different types of mammals and things like that that we might be more familiar with. And I'm also just so encouraged to see so many animal sanctuaries popping up and people really getting excited about volunteering at them and connecting with those animals on a one-to-one basis and helping with the maintenance of those places so the animals can have a more comfortable life, and, you know, people bringing animals into their own homes. My member of my family adopted a rooster, and so now she has this beautiful rooster living with her. So I think that it's really encouraging that humans are getting more connected to the animals that we're talking about. I think that's really important.
Yeah, and going off of like what you mentioned about the tragic being, which is something we often see, like you said, in animal rights communities, and also in queer and trans communities, when we all only really hear stories of people being brutalized or murdered in some way. I think there's definitely a lot of value in sharing the stories that identify the joy and personality of the individuals involved. But do you think there's ever a place to discuss or share stories, images of the violence that is present in their lives, since that's what we seek to eliminate?
Well, I think that it's important to talk about oppression and violence. But I think that if we can really share stories of how people are being able to escape that, and how sort of using it more as a call to action, like this is something that's totally unnecessary and we have the power to stop this kind of violence that's happening every day, like I said, in a very casual way, I think that that's really what we should be focusing on. So, and the other thing is that the sight of dead animals is really hard for me, and I feel like we can show animals who are sick but who maybe have some hope if they can make it to a sanctuary. I just think that if we really show mutilated types of bodies, that's not going to be motivating to a lot of people, because unfortunately that's the kind of way that people are used to seeing animals already. And so I don't think that animal rights groups have to be perpetuating that. But I do think that talking about oppression and violence is still essential.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see like how it makes the animal seem to not have any autonomy over themselves and kind of like disempowered in a way. So also as an out polyamorous individual, does your polyamory influence your activism in any way? And what are the connections, if any, to your queer animal liberation work?
So I think that's actually a really interesting question that maybe people wouldn't necessarily be able to understand unless they're used to seeing the world in that kind of way. So I have been poly for maybe a couple of years, and I really appreciate that kind of mindset, because I think that it's a way to think more abundantly about the world. And also, I think that it fits in well with the whole ethic of bodily autonomy and respect for life and making sure that people are, you know, non-human and human people are able to go seek out the relationships that are really fulfilling to them. So I am able to love my partner and also love or be in relationship with other types of humans, which I find very fulfilling, because those different relationships all feed me in different sorts of ways, and hopefully I can offer different types of things to different people. And I think that in activist communities, it's unfortunately common that people come at activism from a sort of scarcity mindset, because it is true that there's a certain amount of time and energy that we have in our activism, but I think that we can really be more generous in terms of connecting the dots. So if there are other groups who are doing work that we think is really valuable, I think it's important to go and support their work, and then hopefully they can come in return to support our work. And I think that it's important to challenge the other activist communities that we're a part of that aren't focused around animal rights, and really challenge them in thinking about how the types of food that they're buying is a manifestation of their values. So, for instance, if somebody is doing anti-violence work, or if somebody is doing a fundraiser for a no-kill animal shelter, for instance, we can really challenge them and say, think about how your views and your ethics and values as an organization could be supported by having a nonviolent type of meal, or having a meal where animals were not killed. And unfortunately, a lot of places, you know, they don't necessarily make those connections. And so I think it's important for us as animal rights activists who are involved in other communities as well to really confront those kind of issues directly and ask those difficult questions to people.
Oh, very powerful. That was very powerful. And I think it's so true, especially when coalition building with other groups. Yeah. And what, like, going back to animal liberation groups, do you think there are any changes that could be made within those communities to make it more inclusive to queer and gender nonconforming or trans humans?
Well, I think that I would have the same expectations in an animal liberation or animal rights group that I would in other activist circles. So I think that there's generally a lot more acceptance around, I mean, there is a lot more acceptance around talking about human oppression. So I feel that in my activist circles, it's very acceptable to call forward somebody who has inadvertently said something racist or ableist or sizist or what have you. But it's much less acceptable. So I think that we can bring that sort of thing to an animal rights group. So if there's somebody who uses gender-neutral pronouns like I do, I think it's perfectly reasonable that that person should be gendered properly when they're working with their animal liberation friends. I think that, you know, I think that it's important that venues, if we're planning meetings and things like that, should be wheelchair accessible, whether or not we're expecting somebody to come in a wheelchair, just to lay the groundwork to make it accessible so that people who do have those kinds of needs can feel more welcome in even showing up. I think that, you know, a lot of people don't have transportation, especially if we're going to a sanctuary that may be very far away, or if we need, you know, a car to carry materials. I think that organizing carpools is really helpful for people. So just kind of the things that we would do in our other activist circles, I think we should be doing in our animal rights circles.
Great. That's all the time we have today, Hannah. I just want to thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll be in touch in the future.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Bye.
You're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio. We broadcast live every week, noon to 1 p.m. PST, and the station is on the territories of the Coast Salish nations that have never been surrendered. There's no treaties on this land. So that's our show for Pride. Happy Pride. It is a celebration. It also has strong roots of, you know, anti-establishment and oppression, and the politics are kind of gray and muddied, but, you know, there are events happening this weekend that that are more in line with the kind of original vision of Pride, and those can be found fairly easily. If you want to stay in touch with Animal Voices, please do visit our website. It's animalvoices.org. There you can plug into our social media and stay up to date as to what we're having on the future shows. And all our past shows are there on our website as podcasts at animalvoices.org. We love to hear from you. Drop us a line at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith, and do tune into our next Animal Voices show on Friday, August 7th. Huge thanks to Jody for helping us today.
Thanks, Jody.
And to Emily as well. We are leaving you with a song. What's the song, Jackie?
It's Which Side Are You On by Bea Dolan.
Sweet. Remember to be kind to animals and have an awesome weekend.
Okay. Don't let them escape unpunished.
A transgender African-American woman is facing trial for murder after an incident outside a Minneapolis bar where she was reportedly harassed and then physically attacked.
Reportedly interrogated without counsel, placed in solitary confinement, McDonald's supporters have said the case is symptomatic of the bias against transgender people and African-Americans in the criminal justice system.
Who let the torch pass, fall in the tall grass? Fire alarm, wires disarmed, what do you call that? Call it predictable political cliches. So when the movie ends, the revolution's dead. Replay the sequence of events that led to these deep divisions. I realize the order wrong, people are in prison. The children wanna know if I believe in the reptilians. I tell them I don't know, but on the TV I see lizards. When action was in fashion, you were such an easy mimic. Bump a stick of coal, lifting grip, no statistic. Grass for the straw man, born again, cynic. Bear where the firebrand sparked my suspicion. Knew you were the type to take the fight like a gimmick and rock the t-shirt when your sweat wasn't in it. The clock is still ticking for the victim of the future. You wait until they look like you to ever choose, but
I'm dealing with homophobia in hip-hop, the lyrics and things like that.
That homo?
Yeah.
Are you talking about?
Yeah.
I can't even talk to you about that.
Ask the industry.
What I represent culturally doesn't condone it whatsoever.
Do you think that a gay rapper would ever be accepted in hip-hop culture?
Who wrote the greatest lines of our generation, but couldn't get from under they own small-minded hatred? The same rappers say they troop in the front lines and casually use the word faggot as a punchline. That's not a man, that's not a tough guy. That is a sucker and a fraud to the culture. Hip-hop is folk music grown from the struggle, and half these fools could put the mic down and run as a Republican. Fuck them, then they learn from their own wrong. Homophobes don't go to my shows, we too strong. And if you in the front row harassing girls during a song, I'ma reach out and ask you exactly.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
You ain't gotta like it.
Which side are you on?
This is what we're faced with. And this is the reality now. When we come to Washington in this campaign, we're coming to get our check.
I'm on the side of poor people getting organized. I'm on the side of choice where it is in short supply. I'm on the side of those the system doesn't authorize. LGBT, we are on the side of pride, justice and equality. Egypt and Wisconsin when they march against the policy. If you bring me down a king, I'm on your side probably. Kids are giving me shit for this, it really doesn't bother me. They were not around when we were wrestling with poverty. So I follow running and ask no one to follow me. Use your own mind, use your heart and your anger. Check yourself because apathy is a cancer. And let your action be the
which
answer.
Which side are you on? 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 Which side are you on?
Ask your government.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Ask your media.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Ask yourself.
Which side are you on?
Got a chance unless we organize.